everyone. Welcome back to the Artist Care and Feeding podcast. I am one of your hosts, Caitlin Barrett, and with me is my very good friend and co-host, Kathleen Falsani.
Hello.
And our silent partner, Mark, who is also our producer. Our guest today is a very good friend of both Kathleen's and mine. We went to school together. We've known him for decades. He continues to be a fascinating person and in conversation. Julian Jackson, who calls himself an experience designer. And if you want to know more about that, you should listen because here he is. Hi, Julian.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing? It's nice to see you.
I'm doing pretty good. It's been a great day here.
Yeah. Has it?
Yep.
Has it? That's the only place in the world where it's a great day. So for everyone listening, we are recording this on Election Day. And
at 3 p.m.
PST.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So no results
polls,
yet, but
polls
we're going to attempt.
Polls close in D.C. in 2 hours.
Yeah, we're going to attempt to talk about, other things.
More if we're all still things. Here by the time this airs.
Yes.
Just for context.
Exactly.
I'm an optimist.
Undoubtedly, it's going to come up in conversations, so just bear with us. Okay, so we always start with the same question to begin with, which is, artistically speaking, sir, how would you describe yourself?
I would describe myself as an experienced designer. And that's a little bit of an unusual term, but for me, it really describes the idea of not working with a particular medium, but rather thinking about the experience that the viewer or the person engaged with the work that you're doing is having internally, the experience that they're having, essentially.
So more of a kind of a global sort of idea around design?
I don't know.
Like what separates an experienced designer from a designer, I suppose?
Well, some of that is just identifying what it is that you're sort of focused on, because people have been doing experience design for a really long time. I mean, really any good playwright or musician or architect or designer or in many cases artists are creating an experience for someone else. And most of those folks, I think, are engaged in some sort of conversation with their audience. And that, I think, is really what experience design is about. I think identifying it specifically as experience design is a little bit different in that it moves a little bit away from the medium itself and thinks more about kind of that mental conversation that you're having with folks encourages the person taking on that role to use as wide a palette as possible, to think as broadly as possible about how do we tell this story together? How do we engage this person and get them to engage with us? And so whether it's light or smell or visuals or the structures that you're walking through, any of that can really be part of that conversation.
I read a quote recently that was saying that an artist's job is not to solve a problem, but to, in a sense, define a problem or present a problem. And that I think the implication, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that it is basically essentially what you're saying. You are creating problems that people then solve in some particular way, which engages them. And then the experience around those things becomes a larger thing than just a thing you've created or a reaction that they've had. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I'm not sure I've heard it articulated quite like that, but I like that. I quite like that. No, go ahead.
But you don't design escape rooms. You design...
Though you should, maybe.
Although I would pay good money
love escape
to go
rooms.
I know you do. When you talk about experience design, what has that meant for you, and how did you come to that particular vocation or vision of what you're doing as a creative?
Well, as I look back on the career, I'm not sure I could have ever sort of defined the path from the beginning. It wasn't like I sort of aimed at something and worked for years and hit it. There was a lot of great opportunities that presented themselves, and one led to another, and the skill set built over time. I sometimes like to say that it makes a lot of sense looking back, but I could have never chosen the particular path.
Right.
A lot of my recent work has been in museums, creating experiences within museums that people enter into. And the museum is kind of an interesting social place where the information is rich and dense. But there's also the opportunity to sort of engage people on the full spectrum of their senses. And they are willing to spend a little bit of time with you there. There's sort of an agreement by them coming into these locations. And so that conversation can be exciting and passionate, or it can be a little bit more leisurely and intellectual. There's just a lot of opportunity within that kind of a space to create experiences that people don't have in other environments.
And that reminds me, okay, so for context also for the audience, we've known you for a very long time because we all went to college together.
Eons and eons.
Eons, decades even. But when I was in Appleton, Wisconsin, I saw the Houdini exhibit that you had designed for the museum there. And I feel like that is a perfect example. I also went to the Adler while you were working at the Adler. And in every one of those cases, there was a lot of exhibit elements that were very physically interactive that were, and it wasn't just like, I think at the Adler, it was primarily for kids, the section that was really interactive in that way. Yeah. But the Houdini exhibit, there was like a bunch of actual gear you could put on a straitjacket. You could get in and out of a box. You could be disappeared, you know? And it was, that's the kind of thing that comes to mind when I think of you and the way that you design.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that is pretty important to me in that kind of design, I mean, of course, the visuals are important. Of course, the content is incredibly important. But that conversation that I don't know why I like that word today, but today I'm calling it that conversation. But often the way that I like to talk about it is that experiences are much richer and more memorable if the experience has space for the audience or the participant, unless you're a participant, really, to make it their own, to they see themselves reflected. Their actions have consequence. It's just not a complete experience until somebody has entered the room and starts engaging. And that's a little bit of a scary way to design. I think designers in general tend to be people who like to control all of the aspects.
Right. They want observers. They don't want participators. They want control.
And that idea of participatory design, another buzzword there, but the participatory design is like doing design on hard mode, in my opinion, because you are allowing space for somebody else to kind of enter in and mess with your stuff. And you have to account for that in what you design, but also have a degree of confidence in the story that you're telling together. Right. You have to trust your audience to a degree that I think is, well, it's just a little scary. What are they going to do when they come in here? And nowadays, I mean, you mentioned the Houdini Museum, which incidentally was a very, very early project that I worked on. But
And I didn't even know you had designed it until I think I posted pictures on social media. And you were like, hey, that's me. I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Well, that was a long time ago, and there were obviously a number of other really talented folks involved, but it is a very hands-on exhibit, and that's probably going to be rethought in the near future. Our experience with COVID, which we are also in the middle of, is going to change the way that we think about that physicality in those environments. I hope we don't stop being physical in public spaces. But we will have to rethink that. We will have to be more careful about it. We'll have to just think about what that means and how to make it safe for everybody.
Have you already begun the process of creating things that are COVID safe so that when someone asks you, do you have any ideas, you have things?
I can't say that I have created anything during COVID, which I feel fits exactly into that. But I began thinking a lot about touchless interactivity some time ago, simply because there's some physical constraints in museum spaces that are, well, being touched all the time. And the more something is touched, the more likely it is to get dirty or break or other things like that. And museums are heavy use places. There are thousands and thousands of people going through that exhibition and messing with that stuff. And no matter how robust you make it, eventually that has an effect on it. And so thinking about how to have the space respond to people in a way that that is either renewable in some capacity or requires less of that physical touching is something that I've played around with a fair bit. So you know this because we've chatted before, but before I went inside of museums, for several years I had a company called Nogonaut. And the idea for Nogonaut was really this idea of bringing digital interactivity into that physical environment. And one thing we did a lot within that space is, and this is before before this became commonplace. So we were doing a lot of bootstrap R&D. You know, we had this roller coaster R&D cycle, but we were trying to figure out how to use infrared cameras, motion sensors, other things like that to read where people were in the room, to have like, say, an avatar of some old-timey guy with a straw hat turned towards you and follow you as you walk across the room. And if you touch the right thing, it goes, hey, that's the thing I invented way back in 1900.
That's great. I want that. Yeah. Yes, please.
It's almost like a VR. It's like an interactive VR sort of scenario.
And this was a little bit before that became commonplace. I mean, like now there's the... and I'm suddenly blanking on, there's now game systems that are sort of focused around this camera interaction that are just off the shelf. And man, I wish I had that when we were trying to figure this out. We
would have
just, you know, reverse engineered it and put it in place. But
where there's a will.
Yeah. So things like that are the kinds of things that I think are at least a foundation for thinking about that interactivity without the potential of passing germs.
There's an interesting component to that too. When you're rethinking how touchless interaction, it opens up spaces in a new way to people who maybe have physical limitations.
That's right.
Who aren't able to, you know, lift a hand up and touch something or what have you, press buttons on something.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, one of the thing just going up a level here that I really like about experience design is it's often multi-level design too. You're sort of thinking about allowing people to engage on multiple levels. Right. And that opens up a lot of doorways to folks who have some physical challenges or learn in different ways. They there's just more opportunities to engage with the story or the content or the artwork that you're sort of featuring.
I'm sure Caitlin was going to bring this up, but my mind I just saw something in my office out of the corner of my eye that made me want to say, speak to me of artichokes.
This is a good one.
So this is a story from when we were all going to college together. The three of us were doing theater together. I actually entered theater in kind of a strange way. I knew carpentry And so I got recruited to sort of help build sets and work in the scene shop. And then people sort of dragged me onto stage, and I fell in love with it. And I fell in love with the idea of including the way that people tell stories and interact with one another and lighting and costumes and all that kind of stuff. But
the ultimate experience design.
Yeah.
Technically, I was an art major.
Right.
And so when senior year finally came along for me, I had to think about what my final project was going to be. And in addition to carpentry, I'd worked my way through college illustrating children's books, and I kind of had this style. It was all cramped up, and you know, I would like draw really fine line pen and ink drawings and things like that. But that didn't really engage me kind of on an artistic level. It was a great way to tell stories, which is sort of part of my creative love. But it didn't feel really like art because it was so highly controlled. And I began thinking about this idea of including other people into it. I'd done a lot of improv with my fellow actors and actresses.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second?
Yeah.
What is tightly controlled about that type of illustration? Like, what do you mean by that?
I think for me, I would get a very definite idea of what I wanted, and then it would be more of a rendering than it was a process of
discovery
Discovery. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
So it felt a little more mechanical and, you know,
watchmakery.
I was pretty good. And I love being a crafty
indeed.
Kind of guy.
Yeah.
But the feeling didn't feel like what we were discussing in those art classes.
Right.
Like we were talking about the process of discovery, the process of pushing boundaries and illustration. I confess, my art professors tended to be, you know, they were like, well, that's very nice,
right.
They were a little dismissive with the whole illustration thing.
I was just listening to a podcast that they were interviewing R. Crumb and Art Spiegelman, two comic producers of the 60s, cartoons and comics. I'm not sure about the difference between those two. But they said that in the art world, illustrators are at the bottom of the respect totem pole. And they didn't get into it. But I thought that that stuck with me. So immediately when you said that, I wondered if it's that same idea that there's less creativity or personality involved, maybe.
I think that's probably true, though. And I want to be clear that I actually think that there are illustrators out there, even comic book artists out there, who don't have the same experience with that medium that I did.
Right.
And I still like drawing, don't get me wrong. But I think that there are folks out there that push boundaries, that tell incredible stories, that, you know, R. Crumb is an example. Right. You know, you can read his work as sort of this antisocial perspective on the world sometimes. And just it's just a cartoon.
Subversive.
But I actually think he delves into the way the lines work and the way the stories work. And he uses the medium and he pushes it and reshapes it.
Yeah, certainly. And defined it.
There's a great book called Understanding.
Understanding.
Yeah. There's a great book called Understanding Comics. And I'm blanking on the name of it here. It's on one of my shelves. It delves into comics as a art form and as a storytelling medium that can match any of the high arts. And it makes a very, very persuasive case that there is brilliant, brilliant storytelling and brilliant, brilliant art being created in that medium.
Yeah. I mean, tons of graphic artists. And of course, Art Spiegelman won a Pulitzer for Mouse.
Absolutely.
So
Art Spiegelman's a great,
a lot of people who
agree
with you. Yeah. But we got away from the subject of artichokes. I didn't mean to divert quite so far.
That was my experience. And I did actually find employment later with that kind of artwork and that sort of tightly controlled type of artwork. But at least for my senior show, I was intrigued by taking what I was learning in the theater about cooperating with other people, about creating spaces that others entered into and were changed by.
Right.
Mm. Kathy and Caitlin and I had this guru,
Gemma mentor. We should have a Gemma bell every time his name gets mentioned.
Oh, that is a great idea, actually, or a sound effect. We'll work on that.
I'm sure he gets mentioned a lot, right?
He does.
Yeah, he comes up frequently.
And one of the things that I really appreciated about what he was teaching us is this idea of openness to all sorts of different artistic influences on us. Would send us into the city in what was ostensibly a theater class to experience sculpture or something else like
music,
that. And so this idea of creating experiences wasn't the language that we were using. But when we were doing improv, when we were building sets, when we were sort of co-creating in a couple of different ways, that was really interesting. And I also had this skill set of carpentry. I could build things. And there was what I learned of as installation art, the idea of that art that gets built within a space and then you encounter it.
Right.
And that's sort of where I headed. It was an opportunity to sort of think about the stuff I was learning in that theatrical experience, to play with light, to play with people moving through the space, to have a human centered artwork that was not complete until people occupied the stage, if you will. And that artistic thinking. And they're referring to it as an artichoke because the title of the piece was called Artichoke Soul. It came from childhood image that I had in my head that when they talked about souls, I imagined this thing, which I can only describe as looking something like an artichoke. The thing that was inside of you, you know, when you go to Sunday school and they called you a soul, and what was true about you were these multiple layers, these leaves that sort of surrounded something true at the center. And so without going into all of the thinking in that, that's the source of where artichoke soul came from.
And go ahead, Kate.
Oh, I was just going to say, so how did you choose that particular theme? I mean, outside of it being a childhood visual memory or thought process.
Well, I haven't even thought of this project in years.
But, no, and we keep bringing it up. You're welcome.
Remember that one time 30 years ago?
I'm not entirely certain why this became intriguing to me. But what I did was I actually went out to several elementary and younger school children's classes and asked them to draw me what a soul looked like.
Oh,
come on.
This was part of my process.
I love that research so much. Do you still have them?
That's an excellent question.
Kristen,
I do not know.
The soul.
I can show you pictures of the artichoke soul, but I don't know about that research stuff.
Huh.
And
that's fascinating that you would even think to do that. I love that, Julian.
Wow. You know, there was probably the majority of things were people who draw angels. They would draw, you know, an angel that they saw in something. Mm-hmm. And those were kind of boring to me. Mm-hmm. But the ones that were much more abstract were far more interesting. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't call this a highly scientific method, but at least for me, I saw within those more abstract concepts a similar concept to sort of what I recalled as a childhood, this idea of something that was clutched and protected and had something bright inside in many cases.
Yeah, and layers to it.
There was a lot of sort of this darkness and bright kind of thing that was going on. So when I created Artichoke Soul, I used that carpentry skill. I used sort of this intrigue with light. I've had a lifelong interest in the play of light and shadow in physical environments. And what it looked like, if I can paint a picture for folks, is that there was the tallest portion of it was at the center of the room. It was like a pillar with slats of white painted wood. Mm-hmm. And inside that pillar were several very bright white lights. And hung all around them were mirrors hung on fishing line. And below the mirrors, there were fans that ended up spinning those mirrors. Mm-hmm. So you had the effect of shadows and lights spinning through this room. And then surrounding that, I built my equivalent of these leaves that sort of protected and sort of partially hid what this center point was. But they also created this this play of light throughout the room and created, they were sort of like arching, they were kind of like arching leaves, right, except mm-hmm. a little bit more rectilinear in their sort of form. And they created a bit of a circular maze in the room, mm-hmm. Maybe a proto-labyrinth, if you
yes.
will, that
yep.
people would
right,
walk.
Right, I remember right, it. Right. That's so funny.
And
yep.
I remember it feeling a bit like a gazebo, like an exotic gazebo, the center section, in the way yep. that you could walk in and out of it, and it had openness, and you could see through it, but it wasn't completely open.
That's right. I used a lot of like slatting, mm-hmm. so you could kind of like get a glimpse of what was next.
Right.
Man, you're like maybe this was the source of everything I've done since then, because
seriously,
I talk a lot when I'm doing exhibition design about vistas and sort of drawing you through a space by hinting at what's sort of next. Mm. And I've never drawn that line until this podcast.
Yes.
So,
artichoke.
Yes. Thank you.
Soul. Artichoke soul. It all comes back to the soul.
Yeah, I can dig up some photos to send.
Yes.
Out.
Oh, yes, please.
We'll put them on the website so you can
we
go
sure
and
will.
See this originating design piece.
Well, hopefully they don't underwhelm. It was long time ago, but
well, what's kind of interesting is like after now hearing you describe it, there is a like an image in my mind, and so in my mind, I'm like, I want to go mm-hmm. see that thing, no matter what color it is, no matter what size it is. Like, I want to go see it because it's all of those little things together seem like an experience mm-hmm. I want to see. And yeah, it's definitely not going to match what I've thought up, but it's going right. to be something like that, which I find so interesting. It makes me want to go find this thing now.
Well, maybe I should have all of you draw what you think it is.
There you
no.
go.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, that seems like a rational approach.
This could be artists. This could be audience appreciation.
For real.
Like, okay,
I'm literally
send us your drawings.
Going to go to my niece, who's an artist, and ask her to draw me a picture of her soul.
Please, please share
I
that with me.
I am going to do that
really
tonight.
Curious.
Yeah, I'm going to see her tonight.
I'd be really curious.
I'm gonna ask.
And audience, if you have any little people at your house who would also like to draw us pictures of their soul, you can
yes.
send them to
email
us
and we'll post them.
@gmail.com. Yes. I like this.
I think
resurrecting the artichoke soul.
Fantastic.
Mark, you said one thing that recalled one more story that I think is kind of fun.
Story time.
So it's my senior project here, and people come through it. And this is a very different artistic style than any of the professors. So I really didn't
put it
know
mildly.
What to expect. And one of the professors, so it's sort of a panel. They all get in there with you. I think it was three of them. And then there was me, and I had to essentially defend my work. Mm. And it wasn't intended to be sort of a conflictual type of situation, but they're going to ask mm-hmm. you tough questions, as they should. But I was sort of overjoyed when the professors began debating amongst one another whether there was color in this piece. Now, I had painted everything white,
and you were yes. like, "I can answer that question,"
but. The spinning mirrors had enough space in the glass that they created prismatic, like, glimpses of little bits of color through this, which one professor thought was absolutely essential to the piece. And the other said they didn't see it. They didn't understand it. And they had this pretty significant debate about it. But then
Can I guess
debating
who that one professor was? Was it Shrek? Did he love it with the... Was it him with the prismatic effect?
I think Shrek loved it, but it was Walford who I believe was the one who loved the color in it.
Oh, yeah.
And Walford.
That is a thing that some artists encounter in their life, which I think that is a moment when you know you are actually an artist. Is there's a story of, and I'm blanking on the writer's name, but there's a writer who was in his book there, every time it was like a certain character that there would be a lot of fire attached, another character there was a lot of water. And somebody was like, oh, you're using these tropes of like fire for this character and water for this character. And he goes, I am?
Yes.
And right. Like people discovered these right. things that were details. And so you can't say that it's not that, but the guy who wrote it saying, I didn't do that intentionally. What is your opinion of the light of the artichoke? Like, was it incidental color or was it, because that was the sole source of color, that's what you were looking for. Like what, which was
it? Yeah, was it intentional?
Were you trying to make it fire or were you not?
Honestly, I don't think it was. I think, however, that the idea of those spinning lights and the sort of disorientation of the spinning lights and shadows in this space were intended to kind of deepen the experience and like throw off the people who were wandering through it. And if I was to go back and kind of look at it with my lens, I guess I am going back and looking at it with my lens now, I would say that was also early playing around with leaving space for people to interpret that in new ways, to sort of complete it with their own experiences that they had within that. That probably is overly generous to me that I would have thought that through.
No, I mean, at that time. Knowing you at that time, you were and are one of the more curious people. And by that I mean not you are curious, although sometimes you are.
Well, but that too.
You have a lot of curiosity about everything around you, what things people say, why they say them that particular way, what things look like, which is what made you a really good caricature artist. I remember talking to you about that quite some time ago. And you were talking about the ways that people's faces move and the trying to capture their personality in a picture and all the things you have to pay attention to. So I feel that even if you didn't recognize it, it was definitely part of the process for you to leave space so that you could curiositively watch people encounter it.
Yeah. And Caitlin, I think that to some degree, you're hitting on something that I resisted a little bit back then, but the art professors did know, and they were trying to teach me, and I probably, I was picking up on it perhaps at a subconscious level, which is this idea of art as a process of discovery.
Right.
And that my tightly controlled illustration, which really that was very tightly controlled for me, and it wasn't really a process of discovery, which I think they were validly pushing me on, was coming out in some way in this other medium that I had less control over because people were in it. People were messing with it. They were climbing around it. They were encountering it. They were viewing it from different angles that I expected.
Right.
And
seeing color.
They were helping me discover this piece. Like, I wasn't being able to articulate it back then because I was still trying to hold everything pretty tight. But maybe at some subconscious level, I learned something in art classes.
I'm glad that we've gone backwards in the time machine with you because I'm not you, but I can see the breadcrumbs from there to what you've been doing for the last couple of decades at least.
And you've just gotten better at it and developed more tools to kind of expand your repertoire, I think.
Yeah.
Does that feel accurate?
I think that's right.
Did you say that you were you did caricatures? Caricatures? Was that a business, a summer job or something? Where did you do that?
Yeah, that was a summer job. while we were going to college together, I went to the local Six Flags and got a job doing caricatures in a booth for a summer. To this day, I cannot smell bear claws and not sort of get a little nauseous. But
well, and you talked about your hands cramping up too, because it's like a lot of really weirdly intense physical labor with your fingers.
It would be 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Oh, goodness.
And at the end of the summer, I could hold my two hands up and I had like bulging muscles on my right hand.
A Hulk
hand? I kid you not. I was like, rah!
It's like, who's that superhero that has the one huge...
The one big hand?
Just one big
hand. The one big hand, the red guy.
Is there a superhero like that?
Hellboy. That's
Hellboy?
Oh, yeah. Yes, right. He's like my favorite.
Weird.
No, I'm serious.
No, I believe you.
Like, there are two comic books that I collect, and Hellboy is one of them.
So. Really? What's the other one? I'm curious.
It's called Beasts of Burden.
I feel like somebody was just talking to me about that, or I saw a show that was about that, or what were you doing when COVID started locking everything down back in March?
So back in March, I was working for a very large events and exhibition company. I think it might be the largest in the country. And I was doing creative strategy for these large conventions and trade shows and other things, kind of looking at the whole creative strategy for the whole event. I wasn't designing like individual booths in the trade show floor or just the signage, but kind of looking at the whole thing and saying, how do people go on a journey through this? Kind of highfalutin language for some of the actual work that we were producing, but it is valuable to sort of think about people engaging with these conventions as a journey, if you will.
Like
everything
a,
from
like
the
a
very
theme
first
park, almost.
Yeah.
Or, you know, an interactive artichoke.
That's right.
I mean.
So just some examples of some of the folks I was working on. I was working on the National Broadcasters Association. Convention, you know, in Las Vegas, and the AAM's convention, which is the museum community's convention. I was, you know, sort of designing the show for them. It was a little bit of work that was an interim position, I think, in many ways for me, sort of figuring out sort of what was coming next. I had just finished up a stint as an executive director at a museum where I had sort of stepped out of that creative role and was, you know, raising money and dealing with the
problems.
Board and all of those other things. And they were deep in debt when I took on the job, and it was my job to kind of get them out of debt in a year. It was a very stressful year, though we managed at the end to sort of pull it out and I was able to pass it on to a really great successor executive director who had expertise in that particular area. So this company came along while I was still the executive director and sort of tempted me with this job that kind of put me back into creative. And I was exhausted and I thought I would take it. But I knew that it probably wasn't going to be a forever job. However, I did not expect for COVID to come along and essentially decimate that entire industry.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. I mean, all of those things that you've...
pretty much everything I'm involved in.
Yeah, essentially.
Including, we know your lovely life partner is, Kristen is a pastor, right?
She is.
So even you've had to figure out how to do church in a...
Zoom church.
Zoom church.
Yeah, and her congregation, it's my congregation too, but our congregation is about two-thirds people born outside of the United States, mostly refugees. So we speak amongst us, or I don't speak, but together we speak five or six different languages. And one of the joys of sort of being part of that group of people is this multi-layered way we communicate through food, through dance, through art, through music.
Right. All of which require togetherness.
Zoom church compresses that down and leaves a much more limited palette mm-hmm. by which to communicate with one mm-hmm. another. I don't mind it so much because I'm a talker, as you've probably figured out. but the conversations that we have with a lot of other folks, and this isn't just that situation, but mm-hmm. in rich relationships, we have conversations on multiple levels.
Yeah.
Outside of words. And all of our conversations have become a little more constrained, I think, mm-hmm. because of being having to be socially distant from one another.
Do I remember there being a video project or a music project you've done?
It was an Advent. It was something like that, though.
It was. Easter? It was for Pentecost.
Oh, Pentecost. Ah, Pentecost. There we go. Pentecost. Ding, ding, ding.
And again, you know, it's been very difficult to sort of not be able to engage with people in the ways that I've been used to, we've all been used to, but mm-hmm. Like many people, I've been trying to find ways to kind of use those limitations and do interesting things with them. Mm-hmm. So, and now we're going to hark back again to Artichoke Soul. But one thing that I could communicate to all these different language groups, multiple age folks, I asked them to draw. Mm. And again, I was not making these connections until this podcast here. But
I love it. I know.
Pentecost, one of the things that folks celebrate during Pentecost is flames that imply that these people are all bonded within God's Holy Spirit. Sort of appear among the faithful. And so the flame imagery is sort of a key image around the festival of Pentecost. Mm-hmm. So I asked everybody to draw me flames. All these different language groups, all these different ages, I kind of said, make it, you know, about yay big. And I distributed, I actually put these things in a pocket on the door of the church. So we didn't even have to drive around and hand these things.
They could just stop by and grab them.
And I said, be as creative as you want with these. Do whatever you want. And people made beautiful artwork. They included glitter and paint and scraps of cloth and little puffy fuzz balls and just all sorts of different things. All sorts of different medium. They used a wide variety of colors, though one great thing about flame is that it keeps it within a relative close color scheme.
Right. Yeah.
And then I had all of them turn these things in. I took all of these pieces of artwork, scanned them all in, and then animated them. So I had I had a flickering flame made up of all of these different mediums. And then I took the pictures of all of these amazing people. You know, all the colors of the rainbow are represented here from all over the world. And took those pictures and kind of animated those two things together. You know, my video editing skills are modest at best. But I was able to take these flames and sort of put them over people's heads or growing amongst them. And I set that all to Van Morrison's Wherever God Shines His Light. And
very nice.
Right?
It was a really nice project that sort of like reflected back on this sense of community and the sense of togetherness and the sense of sort of everybody adding into it, whether it's their image or their drawing, and it created a really nice piece that we then presented via YouTube on Zoom Church. So it was a way of dealing with the hand that we had been dealt, but trying to keep community, trying to keep that ability to do artwork together, to do creative things together. Mm.
You're always literally thinking outside the box.
I know.
You know?
But in so many ways, coming back to that same instinct to create an experience, if you will, that includes everyone who's experiencing it. And it isn't complete unless there are people interacting with mm-hmm. the environment in some regard.
Absolutely. That idea of participatory design. And I don't know, maybe this is a crutch. Maybe this is a crutch that I've needed ever since then, that I love and want other people's voices to come alongside mine. And, you know, if there's anything that I can kind of provide with the designs that I create, it's a space in which other people can participate. And I think there's other people who do a really good job of that too.
Right. I don't think that's a crutch at all. I think that actually it's really expansive.
It just occurred to me, because I had this conversation when baseball was happening and how incredibly boring baseball is without a crowd. And so we were in the living room and we're like, you know, it'd be a cool system. Maybe if someone could think of a way where you could like text a cheer and then the cheer would happen in the stadium. And like, you know, maybe there would be some sort of like digital system that made it so that you couldn't just yell anti-Semitic epithets at somebody.
For instance,
you know, like figure out the nuts and bolts, right? Because anyone who can ruin something, if they'll you let people it, do right. it, they'll ruin it. But the idea that people make art better is 100% true of every kind single of art form. Mm-hmm. It's super. Yeah. Every concert is boring without someone yelling in your face.
That's true. Like,
and that experience, that life is missing from our lives right now. And if anyone could bring it back, it's you.
No
and
pressure.
You're out of the box.
Thinking and experience.
It's you and you're out of the box. You know, like your entire life, you've been geared towards saying that it can't be good without people. And now you're going like, great, here's how we put people back in that thing.
Well, I mean, what you're saying there is something that I've been really wrestling with during this time. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the questions that's come up is things are going to change. They have changed.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out what's next. And it's a very realistic thing to ask, like, is this a time to reinvent? Is this a time to sort of move away from this vision of physical environments and interactivity, social experiences in physical environments, and go all virtual?
No.
Evelyn, no, but really, how do you actually feel about it?
Everything in me resists the idea that the physical experience of art will not come back.
Well, and I think you're right. I think that
to live in that world.
I suspect...
the end.
Actually, I shouldn't say I suspect. I have read some very smart people saying that probably 1/3 of museums will close via COVID.
And venues. And
restaurants are going to be hit that way. Mm-hmm. Theater companies are going to be hit that way.
Happen.
It's going to hurt.
Yeah.
And so for those of us who make our living kind of in those fields, there
Everybody
has to
present.
Be a little bit of a question. Like, do we need to reinvent ourselves, or do we just need to rebuild when the dust clears? And I think that it's probably a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to rethink. We need to take the lessons that we're learning during this time and be better. Mm. I think that virtual experiences have a wonderful, wonderful place. They reach people and niches that would otherwise not have access to these artworks.
But there's something about that physical...
I'm sorry, I'm soapboxing a little bit.
No, I love it. I'm just agreeing with you and I'm cheering you on because I want it expanded. I do not want it to be one or the other. I want this to be a time of expansion.
I don't think the other happens without the one.
That's
true. Honestly, I mean, you have to... You can't tell me that you can lose the experience of standing with 10,000 or 20,000 or 200 other people singing the same words to the same song while the artist is a few yards or 100 yards or 1,000 yards from you.
Right.
There's something I believe, and I think most, well, at least, I believe that there's something alchemical mm-hmm. and spiritual that happens when you're in the physical presence of somebody mm-hmm. else, mm-hmm. when you're breathing yep. the same air, which right now can kill us, we realize.
Right.
When you're singing.
Yeah, that's
the same
maybe
songs.
Not the metaphor, but.
Right.
But, you know, experiencing the vibration this yeah. in your bodies at the same time, I just.
Physically present.
It has to come back. Yeah. I mean, that kind of, it's in an incarnation and creative impulse are basic to what make us humans, I think.
Yeah,
and
I would agree with that.
There's a degree of, I like to call it serendipity that happens yes. when those mm-hmm. situations happen. Not only
that.
Does someone discover color in the thing that you never had color in before.
Yeah,
right.
But I also think that there's social serendipity that happens.
Yes,
you were talking about like being in a concert venue with all these other people and singing together. There is a bonding that can occur that in our increasingly atomized world, I think those social artwork, those social experiences are pretty critical.
Yeah.
And
they're,
you mentioned
they're
at
bonding,
the top of our...
They're bonding yeah. to the humans that... And it, this is like universal, that people who have experienced a thing together that was mind-blowing... They will try to describe it, and then they will say, you had to be there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's it.
That's true.
You had to be there.
That's true.
Like, it's not possible to recreate unless you were in the room while those things were happening.
Fireworks videos.
Yeah.
Just not the same, right?
Not the same.
You try every year to take a video, and it no one ever wants
so
to look at them.
You're
PSA.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, Julian, I know because of the tradition that you come from religiously and because of the work that you've done and just knowing you personally, I know that community building and peace building is mm-hmm. important to you. It seems to me that we're not going to be able to get on the other side of what happens today, what's been happening for the last 9 months, what's going to happen. Everything's been so divisive and so chaotic. Unless we can physically be together and do some of these, you know, healing exercises by replacing a traumatic experience or an entire year's worth of unthinkably traumatic experiences with something life-giving and positive again.
I think that's incredibly important, Kathy. I think you're putting your finger on something really, really critical. I mean, we're already in a time where there's a whole lot of division and tribalism that goes on, misunderstanding of folks. And I'm not here trying to sort of say this is a both sides kind of moment.
Certainly not.
But I do think that the idea of not having social experiences in common environments really exacerbates the divisions that already exist within our culture.
I think you're so right.
And whether it's, you know, watching fireworks or a baseball game or artwork in many fashions, those are those occasions when we often cross paths with people who are a little bit different than us that share that particular interest, but may share nothing else.
Right.
Yep.
You know, they may be wearing a hijab and a cowboy hat, but they're going to have a conversation because, wow, that fireworks was amazing.
Right.
And that social interaction breaks down some degree of that misunderstanding, and that picture of that person you shared that experience with is going to come back when you think of creating a law that will exclude that other person.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, that feels like a lot of weight to put on artwork and creativity.
Well,
but I think it plays a role.
I agree.
I think it can bear it. I think few things can, but I think art can bear it and has to. How is... Given everything we've talked about in your experience, professional and personal, like how do we gather in a way that we need to gather to heal that doesn't physically make us sick? I don't think we've figured that out yet, because we're trying to, you know, keep people alive and keep people from catching this disease.
I don't know that I've figured that out. I think there's two you know, two sets of answers to that. One, which is, how do we make do with what we have right now and find mm-hmm. those moments of magic right now? And then also, what do we learn from this and take it into the next era?
Yeah.
You know, I've never really thought of myself as a producer, but I do like producing events.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like kind of giving other people platforms, whether I feel like it's something that I'm designing and that other people enter into, or just giving people a platform for it in some mm-hmm. capacity. And a while ago, just at the end of summer, we had some friends who were looking for a place to do some session music. They're doing Irish mm-hmm. music.
Mm.
And usually you go to your local Irish bar and you have a session on Sunday. And
the heaviest of
sighs.
Remember those days.
Mm.
And we live here in the city, and we don't have a big house or a big yard, but we do have a house and we do have a yard, which many of the other folks did not. So I said, yeah, come on over. It'd be great. You know, I'm going to sit on my porch over here and I get to listen and, you know, gosh, isn't this great? But the cool thing about this is our yard is sort of in the bowl of all of these apartment buildings. And if you know Chicago, the back porches of these giant apartment buildings are these big wooden structures stairs going up the back, and people like cram their plants and their grills and everything else and patio equipment all on these things.
Kickboxing stand, yoga mats.
That's right. and our yard is kind of down in this unintentional bowl between all of these different apartment buildings.
Mm.
And as these session musicians were playing, I began to notice people were coming out onto their porches.
Oh, how great.
And kind of gathering with this idea of live music. Mm. And we created an accidental amphitheater right there.
Amphitheater, I love it.
And they would cheer, you know, they would cheer and they would yell over it, like, what was that song? And, you know, the musicians would yell back. And
a live performance.
We got that moment of serendipity, that connection between people who would never cross paths otherwise.
So
I can't say that I had intended for that to happen, but I think people are trying to find those moments where we can do that in the short term.
Yeah, right. I agree with you. It's not ideal, but I would rather watch an hour and 8 minutes of Bruce Springsteen in his home recording studio with the E Street Band making an album, even if it happened a year ago, than not have it. I mean, or 30 seconds of Patti Smith
serenading voters,
singing People Have the Power slightly off key with Lenny, her guitarist. I mean, it's just... I literally just cannot get enough of those moments, and they invariably move me to tears because I miss it so much. I miss being with other people, but I miss experiencing live music, dancing together. There was a video today, because again, we're recording this on the evening of Election Day 2020, which Bruce Coburn's song, If This Was the Last Day of the World, just started playing in my head when I said that.
God willing,
sure,
not.
That's not the case.
No.
No, if you're listening
today,
to this.
Satan.
Not today, Satan. I was wrong. But I think it was a picture out of lots of great stuff coming out of Philadelphia today. And it was some video of a very long, hundreds and hundreds of people, most of them African-American, a lot of them elders in the community, who were doing the electric slide in line while they were waiting for it. Was awesome. People are so clever, just to, you know, they have to be 6 feet apart from each other, but if they have to be near each other to at least get some music out and get moving their bodies together, it was a joy to see.
Right.
That's awesome. I love
but
that.
But this is outside of COVID. In this year, this is probably the one event that is bringing people together more than almost anything else, because you have to be in certain states public. You have to be out in public in order to vote. And it is, I feel, impossible to have lived through this year and not know that there's an election happening.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, It that and COVID are the two things about 2020 that every single living being on the face of the planet knows is happening.
We might not agree about
no.
why
no
or
agreement.
What should happen, but that it is happening.
Awareness, most of yes. us. Agreement, yeah. never.
No, forget it.
Yeah.
You know, Julian, I seem to remember, I know there's a piece, we want to talk a little bit about your writing. There's a piece that you've written that you're planning to perform sort of a la the moth or similar
live storytelling.
Live storytelling things. But I remember a story about something you designed for one of your children's birthdays.
Yes.
Which I said, you know, you're not designing escape rooms. This was not an escape room, but had elements of that in it. Can you tell us about
kind of
this? You're like the best dad ever.
Dungeon mastery situation, but ish. In real life.
Yeah. So Caitlin's outing me here as an uber geek here.
Hey, I used to play D&D also. How about that?
So I not only I still play. Occasionally play D&D, uh-huh. but I have even been paid to write some D&D modules.
Oh, I bet you were good at
in
that.
In the distant past.
I bet you were. Wow.
And again, it fits into this idea of creating stories mm-hmm. in a participatory way where the players enter into that story and they change it. You know, mm-hmm. they kind of enter into it. But the party that Kathleen is talking about, I just need to say something.
Yeah.
I actually do work sometimes.
Yeah, but work sounds like so much
yes.
fun.
Yes.
Well, the line between work and play is...
You're
is,
also an incredibly busy person, I would say, most of the time. You yes. have a lot of projects yes. going on. You're not a person who has a lazy boy. So.
Yeah, yeah. Not a lot of that. But when my older son, who is now headed off to college, was younger... you know, now they're going to be terribly embarrassed because this was actually my younger son. I did this to embarrass.
It's okay.
My younger son, when he was, I don't know if it was 7 or 8, he was just starting to really get into fantasy stories. And I might have, you know, encouraged that
no,
interest
slightly.
In him by reading him The Hobbit
put a cape
and
on
other great stories.
And said, yep. Come over here, son. I have a bag of holding for you.
And so for his birthday, I decided that I would create an adventure for him. And I had a little bit of extra time. And so we went over to this warehouse-like building. And I took some of those children's stretchy tunnels. I don't know if mm-hmm. you've seen this. It's a bunch of rings and then yep. it's like vinyl between them. And I curtained off sections and I put those tunnels between rooms so that the only way to get from room A to room B was crawling through these tunnels. And I gave him one of these maps that I'd drawn with my meticulous little cramped hand.
Yes.
Crumpled it up and aged it.
Soaked
and
it in coffee.
I handed it to him and said, these are the tasks you must complete in order to get your birthday prizes. And he and 7 or 8 friends set out on this adventure.
Oh gosh.
So I had so much fun doing this. I changed the lighting in all the rooms. In fact, I used this at a spooky storytelling the other day, and this is some of the vinyl I used way back at that birthday party.
Looks
I
just like
dug
a gel.
It out.
Like a lighting
it is.
Gel.
It's a gel.
Oh, it is a gel.
That's exactly
all right.
What it is.
An orange. He's holding up an orange gel, theater friends.
Yeah. So I changed the lighting in all of the rooms. I did sound effects in all of the rooms. And in the first room, they came in and it was dark. But I had some of those fake torches, mm-hmm. you know, the ones with little fabric things and a fan on the bottom and a light mm-hmm. that looks like it's flickering. And there were the drums in the deep and goblins yelling in the distance. And I had drawn a bunch of goblins on little wooden panels that I then balanced up on the shelves and on some tables. And I had one of my friends hiding behind the table, and he began to throw tennis balls at them in this dark room. And they had to throw the tennis balls back and knock all the goblins off before they could proceed to the next room.
It's almost like
a room was a lava room, and we all know how to play lava, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah, but have you ever played lava where the whole room is bathed in red light and you hear the of the lava there? So, you know, that room, and there was a hallway filled with spider webs, and there was a genie that gave a riddle that they had to do. And the final
room.
Were
you the genie? You were the genie, weren't you?
I wasn't. I recruited people.
Yeah.
That's one of my artistic mediums, recruiting people.
That I will attest to that, actually.
Casting.
Did you have people in costume interacting, like adults in costume, like interacting with them also? Or were they all unseen? Or...
They were all unseen except for the genie who had a costume. But in the final room, I had another friend who had been very into papier-mâché, had designed, I paid her to create this giant 3-foot dragon head.
Amazing.
That we then created a giant marionette out of.
What?
And
crazy.
Filled it with gold chocolate coins. You know those gold chocolate coins?
Yeah, the Hanukkah coins. Yeah.
And had somebody on the big microphone going, you have entered the dragon's lair. How dare you? And it ended up being a pinata. So they all went and attacked it with little wooden swords, and then it spilled the gold coins everywhere.
I love it.
Wow.
Best so, dad ever.
For real.
Way more work than I've put into most of the other birthday parties, but that was a lot of fun for me, and I think a lot of fun for them.
That's amazing. So I don't want to give people the impression that during this interminable liminal space we've all been trying to survive these last 7 or 8 months, you've been just twiddling your thumbs and or playing Dungeons and Dragons.
although if you were, that would be fine.
That actually is absolutely fine, but you brought up your work ethic. So what have you been doing to make use of yourself, not just to keep yourself busy or distracted, but what have you been doing or making or creating or, I don't know.
Yeah. How is your creativity
fostering?
Been channeled?
So for some of this time, I have channeled some of that creation of that sort of producing and into creating virtual meetings. And for a while, I went back and did that for the company that I had been working for previous, you know, figuring out what can be moved online. How do you create interactivity for people? You know, do you keep polls running on the side? What do you do with chat functions and Q&A?
Breakout rooms and Zoom things.
Yeah, that lasted for a while, and then that company that I had been working for shrunk even further. But I've used that skill to help out in other places, to volunteer for that. I just did the annual meeting, one of the annual meetings for the Mennonite Disaster Aid. So, you know, talking about hurricanes and tornadoes and rebuilding houses and so forth. And so I sort of acted as the Zoom producer for that, for their annual meeting in a volunteer kind of way. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, some things that were more fun. For me, I produced for years we've been doing spooky storytelling sessions here at our house. And we went virtual this year. But the cool thing about being virtual is instead of trying to get people to cram into our tiny house and spill out onto the stairs and so forth, we were able to invite, you know, a lot of folks.
Yeah.
Across and they the showed country. Up from around, I think we had 10 different states. So,
no
you know,
way.
Texas and North Carolina and Washington and California and Colorado and just all over the place. And we had several musicians and storytellers that I know that I kind of recruited in. So it was probably some of the best content we've ever had because I was able to, you know, cherry pick some of my favorites. I don't know if you know that Jason Herod did a song for us on there.
Jason.
Yeah, another musician we all know.
Right.
Yep. Singer songwriter extraordinaire.
Yeah, so he joined us from North Carolina.
Yes.
So I feel like, I mean, I want to hear more about that, but it feels almost as if when the world corrects and you can have live events again, you could incorporate a Zoom element into this now that you've seen how it. So this is the perfect example of how the constraints actually have allowed you to expand your options instead of eliminating the whole event altogether.
Yeah, I think, you know? I think you are dead on. I think that's an excellent point. I do like the idea of accessibility for people who are not able to attend those live events. I do recognize that there are things that a broader reach really do for people who have less mobility, need assistive hearing devices. There's just a whole host of reasons there are elements of this virtual world that we're in that I think we've learned good lessons from, and I'm hoping to reapply.
I just don't
want to give up on the physical presence either. No,
absolutely not. Yep. I mean, I was just about to say, you know, for people who, like me, who never got to see Hamilton on a stage with live humans play, to be able to watch that on Disney, I mean, that was just, I had no idea how much I had missed the theater. I had no idea how much I missed the kind of thing that only kind of musical theater can do for your soul, I think.
Well, I mean, and for a while at the beginning of COVID, PBS had opened up their Great Performances series, so you could watch a lot of different Broadway shows. And one of the things that I was struck by when I was watching a couple of pieces is the hum of the audience in the background, the little bit of rustly paper and the breathing and the knowledge that even if I couldn't see them, that house was packed with people who were actively watching what I was also watching. And that actually gave me a better feeling of inclusion rather than just seeing something filmed and I'm in my house by myself watching it and there's no reaction to it except my own, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Absolutely does. You know, it's like watching a live concert happen remotely, which it's not the same. No. And I'd much rather be in the room, but if I can't be in the room where it happens, I'd rather be in the Zoom where it happens.
2020 jokes, oh, y'all. Nice. We're going to be here all year.
I have a question about Zoom. Because you've produced things and you think about by virtue of your vocation as a experience designer, what is one thing that anybody in a Zoom conference or at a Zoom event or even a Zoom conversation with family members all over the country, whatever it is, what is one hack or one thing that they could do that would make it better that you know because you've... done a few of these.
Or if you were to redesign Zoom to add an element.
That's a different question, but yes.
Yeah. Part one, part two.
Both of those things. Yeah.
Sure. I think that there are a few features to Zoom that are worth playing around with. There is a polling feature that you can turn on that you can pull up quizzes and polls and things like that.
Kind of like a sidebar kind of thing?
It actually pops up over the rest of the windows. It can only be controlled by either the host or the co-host. They pull it up. There you
added
go.
Added emojis.
It just creates a little bit of dimensionality and feeling like it's a nod to the idea that they are participants too. It helps people pay attention to what's going on and allows them to sort of speak into it. So I've seen that used as, here's a bunch of fun little trivia questions about what we're doing, or here is a motion for our board. Let's get our vote. Let's have everybody actually vote online here. So that provides an interesting sort of side tool
interactivity.
For folks to use.
Right. I wonder if that's how people it's not really people here in the States, but family or friends in the UK and in Ireland where trivia night at the pub is, a convention that's been going on in their, everyday lives for a long time. I've been doing these trivia nights on Zoom and maybe that's how they do it. Could now I want to do one.
It could be. Hmm. There's also a couple apps and games that you can do sort of remotely.
Really?
Have you ever heard of the company You Don't Know Jack?
Yeah.
So You Don't Know Jack has these party packs that can be done remotely. You don't all have to be in the same room, but you can play one another.
Huh.
And with my parents, for instance, you know, they're living a couple hours drive away from me. And one of the things I've done with my sister and her family and my parents is play, you know, You Don't Know Jack games using Zoom so we can all kind of see each other.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Hmm. Writing that down.
Yeah. And then I discovered something called Game Pigeon. Which is, Game Pigeon? I mean, it's kind of interesting because it's clearly unlicensed in that they have taken a whole bunch of games and then just renamed them because, you know, that's how that works. But
so Scrubble and things like that.
Chockers. But the great thing about it is that you play it on your phone, and as soon as you take a turn, it texts the person that you are playing with. So, yep. And then they play and it texts you. So you can interactively play, and it's much like Words with Friends, only you have a multitude of other options. You can play Battleship, which they call Sea War or something like that. I mean, and
like,
you know,
Hydrox.
But it's that I have spent hours, especially really? During quarantine. Yeah, there's a bunch of word games. There's a whole bunch of different other games, and yeah, friends. I have a couple friends that I played with. We played Moncala, which I hadn't played since I was a kid.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Wow.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
Yes. So to Caitlin's other, to her question, the part two of this, you know, what would, if you could design one feature for Zoom to make it, or whatever.
Right. To make it more experiential.
To make it more experiential or enhance the experience, what would that be? And you can't say smell-o-vision.
Oh, well, I mean, you could.
Oh, that would be great. You could.
So,
you could, like, come out of the speakers of your laptop.
True story. I proposed in one of those early virtual sessions that we send people packages beforehand with progressive mini packages within them that they would open at certain times.
Oh, my gosh.
That would include food and scented things and other things
this.
Like that.
Yes.
Ooh, do that.
Especially,
do that.
Especially for a trade fair. Like, they're always giving shit away. Yes.
But can you imagine if you had an event and you could say, get this together in time for people to order it for Christmas? It's like those mystery packet games.
Mystery games. Mm-hmm.
But there's a mystery, where they send you clues. It's several packets. Yeah, it's the mystery package game. Yeah, and they send you, like, you know, stuff to go along with that. But I love that idea of, like, nesting objects to go along with an experience on. That's brilliant.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Who wants to bankroll Julian to do that?
Well, you said you suggested this, right, to people you were working with? Did they?
I did.
So what was their reaction to that?
Well, you know, not to get too much into the weeds on this, but there are challenges when you're working with 10,000 people.
I don't know what you're talking about. Fine. Pizza cake.
That grows more difficult to sort of send out packages and do the logistics for that. I think that that's very realistic for smaller meetings and events. But I think that that particular one is a little bit challenging.
Yeah. I actually can see it in more of a personal context, like a birthday party or an anniversary party or celebration of something within a select group of people. And you have boxes of things that you can, like, order online and have sent to them. And then everybody opens it at the same time and they get stuff, things, play and participate together.
One of the things that I've thought about is, and I've threatened to do this on a couple of occasions, is to do, like, Five Senses dates with Kristen. And I haven't really done this, so I can't claim, like, that I'm truly awesome.
I'm so surprised you haven't done this. This is right up your alley.
I thought the awesome thing.
Right.
I just haven't done the awesome thing.
Look out, Kristen. It's coming at you. 2021.
But that you, like, there is this small house museum on perfumes in the western suburbs. So like do a smell thing and go and smell what ambergris smells like. Like that's the whale vomit that is used in many different perfumes. Sort of thinking about meals that are aromatic in some way, and then thinking about kind of how do we like lean into this particular sense on this.
You could take her to one of those dinners where it's all in the dark.
All in the dark.
Oh, exactly.
So you don't get any other senses. You just get the food.
That's right. Oh, that's right. So
what a great idea.
Maybe that could be a
big ending too, if you want to, you know, if it's all five senses and then for our grand finale.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, and you could mix that one up too, but I don't know what your rating on your podcast is here. So
it's for grown-ups. So yeah, you could.
But you know, you could do something like you could have something where you have a bunch of M&Ms, for instance, and you have to eat them blindfold off of one another.
What a fascinating idea. I wonder what genius came up with
that
plan.
You just pulled
that
out of the air. Huh.
So do you want to explain what I'm talking about, Caitlin?
Yes. So
wait, oh God. Oh, you know, oh
no, this
oh
is really
dear.
A thing. Yeah. So,
okay.
To set the stage, we went to a
Mark's expression now is priceless.
And I'm going to tell this story, parts of it, not
just tell it,
comprehending where I came up with this idea or how I thought this was reasonable. So I'm just
this is Caitlin's idea.
Yeah. What's my idea? So we went to a conservative Christian college, which by Christian standards was not as conservative as some. It was Wheaton College in Illinois. Yeah. We had a very fascinating director, mentor, person in charge of our theater program. Yeah, guru. Who actually, I have a little caricature in one of my notebooks that Julian drew of him as Yoda. We used to call
him. Do you have that? And you need to take a picture so we can.
I know,
have that.
It's buried in one of my storage sheds. I'd have to think on that. But yeah, Yoda.
I remember you sitting there and drawing. I'm sure you did it more than once, Julian, but I have a distinct memory of. We were auditioning for something and you sitting in the corner, like on the, not on the couch, but on like the arm of the couch, folded up like you would when you were drawing a Jemma as Yoda. Right. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, in almost every class we ever took together, Julian and I were good friends. We'd end up sitting near each other and you would always swipe my notebook and start just doodling in it. So I have a bunch of different, I think you tried to draw me a couple of times also. I don't know that went so well, but I remember you just being like, what is with your nose? And I was like, I don't know.
Like I should talk, Caitlin.
Anyway, all of this to say. So Jim was a huge proponent of very experiential sorts of training. It was not a very, he did not focus so much on the intellectual side of breaking things down, at least not outside of classes. In classes, we would dissect plays and go over character notes and all that sort of thing. But in actual training, we did a lot of very experiential work. Mm-hmm. So that was what we were trained to do when we were taking classes like directing. So when we took a directing class, everybody was assigned a group of people to work with. So I think it was a triad. Is that right, Julian? Am I remembering that?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep.
So you'd work with two other people, and you would direct a play, direct a short scene. You would be in a short scene, and then you would be in two short scenes. So everyone got a turn to direct. I think that the finale portion was when I worked with you and Kristen. So you and Kristen were not dating at that point.
Kristen is my now wife.
Yes.
Of very many years.
Yes. Right. Since college, basically. The final scene was fully staged, costumes, set pieces, and all that sort of thing. And it wasn't quite as informal, but we also worked on it for longer. So I was assigned you and Kristen as my actors for the scene that I directed. I chose a scene from 1,000 Clowns by Herb Gardner. Which I still love. And then, so I also just feel real necessary to mention the fact that I was definitely a virgin at this point in my life.
Yes.
However, we had been doing some what they like to call sexual tension work in the theater program. We had kissing scenes. We had things that were intended to safely explore that sort of thing. And that's enough said about that. Anyway, so the scene that I chose from A Thousand Clowns was a morning after scene where the two characters had slept together the night before, and then it was an awkward morning after sort of scenario, if I remember. And I don't remember what happened in the rest of the scene, because literally when I think about that play, I only think about M&Ms and you and Kristen. So,
yeah.
Your direction.
So you were designing an experience here, Caitlin, is what you're saying. So what was the experience that you thought to design?
In my infinite wisdom as a 19-year-old virgin, I thought that you two were not quite understanding what it would be like to have slept with someone and then woken up next to them and maybe had some regretsies. So one night... And this is the point in which I'm going to let Julian tell the rest of this story. One night, I decided to give you guys a little bit of an assignment to work on your sexual tension. Go.
So Caitlin brought in a big package. It wasn't one of those little fun sizes, mind you. This was a big package of M&Ms.
Not Costco
and
size, but
she
the
said,
in-between one.
We're going to work on this. You know, you're just not comfortable with each other. We're going to work on this sexual tension here. And she opens up this M&M's and she says, we're not leaving here till you eat these M&M's off of one another. You're going to take turns and you can't use your hands. You can use your hands to place, but you can't, you have to eat them without using your hands.
Unbelievable.
And you cannot use the same body part twice.
Well...
What? Why? How?
So this was a multi-sensory, multi-dimensional experience that that we had.
I dimmed the lights.
I dimmed the lights. It was pretty good. I mean, you know, the results speak for themselves.
How long after that did you start dating?
I've been married for 26 years, right?
There you go.
And
how long after that did you become actually romantically involved?
Minutes?
It was almost a... Well, that was kind of romantically involved, whether we called it that or not.
Right, yes.
No, I think we started dating maybe 9 months after that.
Ever gone back to the M&Ms?
You know,
that was my wedding gift to you.
I don't know
guys,
why I would be shy. Actually. After I just told you that story, why would I be shy at all about telling you that?
That's true.
Anyway,
I know what I'm sending the Jackson family for, or maybe just Kristen.
For your wedding gift, I got you a copy of the Kama Sutra and a package of M&Ms.
Big packet of M&Ms.
You didn't.
Yes, I did.
Did you?
She did. She absolutely
yes,
did.
Yes, I did.
That's awesome. Well,
yeah, and I also maintain that half the reason you guys were having trouble with the sexual tension is that there was sexual tension.
Oh, there was.
And it was hard to act like it and not acknowledge it at the same time. So somehow
I think
I got that.
I think we were actually both dating other people at the time. And so like the sexual tension was kind of like, what do we do with this? We don't understand.
Yeah.
How do you like be in a relationship with other people, but act like your relationship? Anyway, we were young.
Yes, that's extremely good.
It is pretty great. Yeah. I still
so
cannot.
Many buckets of M&Ms.
I don't know where the hell I came up with that idea. I don't know why I thought that was okay. I just... My deepest apologies. It feels like...
Seems like it all worked out just fine.
Caitlin, I think you really should have sort of the Love Doctor is In portion of your podcast after this, because...
Oh, you have no idea.
You were very creative there. So.
Apparently. Mm. Give you an M&M and set you loose.
Karen Feeding of Artists and their love lives.
Their love lives. Call me.
Which... leads me to, you know, ask you if you'd read that lovely story about your son.
Perfect segue into the circus and a child.
Yeah, if you wondered actually what happened at the end, I have kids.
Yes, you do.
Sexual tension resolved.
Yes. Way to go, Caitlin.
Hey, you're welcome.
Playing right. the long
game. You're
welcome,
game. Liam and Elijah.
So, in all of these experiences, I have really enjoyed the process of thinking about them as stories that people can participate in some fashion. And I didn't originally think of myself as a storyteller. I realized that a little bit later in my career that I was bringing stories to life, but through mediums other than writing. And I began to want to do a little bit more writing and become a better storyteller myself. And so I've been participating in, up until COVID, in these sort of bar live storytelling sessions, mm-hmm. like The Moth or other similar types of storytelling sessions. And I took a class that was about writing these shorter stories. And just before COVID hit, I started to work through this particular story that I'm about to read that has just a lot of poignance in this crazy, crazy 2020 world for me. And it stars my older son. Our family had been matched with the Rise family because our sons were almost exactly the same age, 2 and 7. They spoke no English, and we certainly didn't speak any Bhutanese. But when we first arrived at their cramped Rogers Park apartment with refugee welcome packets, they ushered us in with huge smiles and chipped mugs of tea to sit on the curry-scented mattresses that represented their only furnishings. Whatever our language shortcomings were, our toddler spoke the universal language of play, and that was soon enough for all of us. It was a few weeks later, and the Rise were given 5 free tickets to Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus at the United Center, and they invited us to go. We decided that the toddlers were probably too young, so this would be a wonderful opportunity for me to bond a bit with the father and for Liam, my older son, to bond with Swachanda, the Rai's 7-year-old. When the big night arrived, we were surprised to find 2 other young men in the apartment with the Rai's. Were these relatives? I wasn't sure. We awkwardly nodded and smiled, as we'd done on previous occasions, until I indicated with signs and pointing that it was time to go. Everybody stood up, and it became clear that these 2 young men intended to go with us. Let's see, 5 tickets, 6 people. No problem, I thought. I can just buy another ticket for myself when we arrive, and we'll figure out the seating later. We all piled into my Prius, the father in front with me and our 2 7-year-old sons and the 2 younger men in back. I handed orange juice boxes to both boys, and we were on our way. Through very limited language, we established that, yes, there would be elephants, elephants at the circus. This caused little Swachanda to get very excited, and he promptly threw up the orange juice all over the back seat. Apparently, he'd never been in a car back seat, nor had orange juice before. So, a little good humor and gas station paper towels soon restored us to our journey. We eventually arrived in the vast wasteland of parking lots that surrounded the United Center. We paid our $15 and joined the festive crowds that were streaming towards the stadium. As we threaded our way to the exterior ticket office, something felt off. There was no line at the window. 1 ticket, please. Sorry, sir. There's no tickets for sale. No tickets? It's a 20,000-seat stadium. You sold every ticket? No, sir. This is our charity performance. We gave away every ticket. But surely there's going to be some no-shows. Yes, sir, but we can't sell tickets in case someone shows up. We'd get in trouble. The crowds around us were starting to thin as showtime approached. 5 tickets, 6 people. 2 7-year-olds and 3 adults brand new to the country. They had no money and couldn't speak or read English. But they were our friends and they were adults. they could keep him physically safe. And Liam could read quite well. There was really only one thing to do. I got down on one knee. Okay, Liam, you're going to have to guide them in. See this? This is the section, and this number right here is the row. The ushers began to close the exterior doors. I watched Liam head off into the interior of this 1,000-seat United Center and hoped I'd given him enough to make it back to me. Boom! The door shut in the Calliope riot of the circus and left me standing outside under the lonely, buzzing blue halogens. Well, I found an empty cop bar several blocks away, lit in dim jukebox colors, where Johnny Cash was musically confirming the mistake I'd just made. I nursed a beer at that bar while trying to compose an appropriate text to my wife. How exactly does one craft a reasonable explanation for sending a 7-year-old into a crowd of 20,000 clowns? I made that beer last for 2 long, anxious hours. Then I was back at the entrance where I'd last seen Liam and the Rise. The doors burst open and the crowds flowed out and around me. If I had thought my 2-hour beer was long, it was nothing to the 10 minutes I stood there craning my neck and waiting for the sight that finally came around the corner and released the bear trap on my stomach. Tiny Liam leaning a line of Bhutanese, all with identical 3-ring smiles. That was the first time I sent Liam off like that. But it hasn't been the last. Now he's 17. There's a 6 college solicitations for him in the mail every day, and I'm beginning to realize that a much longer goodbye is coming. A day I'll watch him head off into a much bigger circus and hope I gave him enough to make it home.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Artist Care and Feeding podcast. If you want to learn more about the artists featured on the show, you can visit our website, artistcareandfeeding.com, where there are links to their socials, our socials, links to some of their work, and most importantly, a tip jar for individual artists so you can help feed the artists. We want to thank our producer, Mark Rivett, Martin Hanlon, and Eric Escalante for the theme music you hear throughout the show, and our man in Sweden, Kurt Leitner, who is the artist responsible for our beautiful logo work. See you next time.